Denmark is widely considered the birth country of wind power, especially offshore wind. But how did it all start? Today I speak to one of the pioneers, Henrik Stigsdal. When he was a very young man, just 19 years old, he built one of the very first wind turbines in the world, and it ended up providing the blueprint for a very large percentage of all turbines today in the world.
We took the best crane driver from our crane supplier. His name was Leif. He said, Leif, tomorrow you're going to drive onto a barge with your big crane, and we'll pull you out to sea. But when you're out there, you just pretend that all the blue stuff out there is green, like grass where you normally work, and then you just do what you normally do. And it worked.
Welcome to Planet A, a podcast on climate change. My name is Dan Jørgensen. I'm Minister for Development Cooperation and Global Climate Policy in Denmark. In a series of conversations, I ask some of the world's leading experts, policymakers, authors and activists how to stem climate change.
We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency.
For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear.
The reason I believe we need to act now is because the facts are staring us in the face.
The time to answer humankind's greatest challenge is now.
L'accord de Paris pour le climat est accepté.
So this gives us the best possible shot to save the one planet we've got.
There is no plan B because we do not have planet B.
You're listening to Planet A, a podcast on climate change and what to do about it. Today, it is an honor to introduce a visionary guest whose impact on the world of renewable energy has left a lasting mark. Joining me on this episode is Henrik Stigsdal, a true pioneer within the field of wind energy. Henrik Stigsdal has many credentials, among them that he had the overall responsibility for Vindeby offshore wind farm back in 1990. It was the world's first offshore wind farm. Today, I talk to Mr. Stigsdal about how it all started. What made it possible for Denmark to become the first country in the world to really push wind power? And where do we go from here? So, Henrik, welcome.
Thanks a lot.
I actually very often have people that's never met you asking how you are.
Uh-oh. Do you then speak politely or honestly?
I speak totally honestly. But the reason, of course, is that, first of all, you're very well known around the world for your important work on renewable energy, especially wind. But also because I used your personal story as a part of a TED Talk that I gave. And a lot of people have seen this TED Talk, and they really love the story about you so much that they want to know, so how is it going? Are you still active? And I tell them, of course, you are extremely active in also even trying to advance new technologies. But we'll get to that. First of all, I would like to start by asking you how it all started. You were a very young man, 19 years old, as I understand it.
Yes.
Take it from there.
Yeah, of course, it's a long story, but the you can say that the starting point was the oil crisis in 1973, yes, when the oil exporting countries, OPEC, introduced an embargo on countries that had been supporting Israel under a recent war with Syria and Egypt. And it affected us in Denmark, not as much as in the US that was the main target, but it still affected us in the short term, relatively dramatically. But in the longer term, the substance was that energy came to be about three times more expensive than what it had been. Yeah. So we came from a situation where it didn't really matter to one where it really mattered. And where I was from, on a farm in the countryside with about 100-year-old buildings, it suddenly became a major thing in the household budget.
Because you had an oil burner.
Yes, we were burning oil. It used to cost one Danish kroner, 15 cents, and suddenly it costed 50 cents per litre. Yeah. And that could really be felt with the sort of buildings we had. And so when I had finished my high school and was having some time off because I had to do national service in the army at some point in time, I came to think, could one do something about it? And my father then introduced me to the twin schools, where which was a place, a teacher's college, where they had had the same sufferings over the energy price hikes and had decided to do something. Yeah. And they had done something that was completely out of reach for me. We will want to build one wind turbine that can do all the energy for the schools. So, incidentally, the world's biggest wind turbine.
Yeah.
And that was in itself a fantastic project that somebody who did not have a large amount of previous knowledge about something like wind power, nobody really did much,
yeah,
could make such a decision and then act on it and actually look as if they were going to succeed with it.
Yeah.
And I found that really inspiring. So after a visit up there, my father and I decided to build just a small turbine, just to get so kind of get to grips with it. So we built a small rotor, the one you showed in the TED Talk,
yeah,
that you could hold in your hands and go out in the wind.
I showed it not in a photo. Well, I
you
also showed a photo, but I had it on stage.
You showed it for real. I still have it, yes.
Yeah.
And it's still as fun and exciting as it was then, that when it starts spinning, it kind of gets alive in your hands, particularly on a windy day with gusty wind. You really feel the power, and it's as hands-on, literally, as it can get.
Yeah.
And that was sort of, wow, here's something. Then I built a 3-meter turbine that I mounted on the farm wagon so we could take it out in the field and measure how much power could it produce at a certain wind speed. And following that, I built a 10-meter turbine for my parents' farm.
How did you know how to do it? You only had a high school exam.
Yeah. The interesting thing was that with wind power, that it was difficult, but if you had the ambition and if you had some energy yourself, yeah, and if you had a basic mathematical, physical background, as I had from high school,
yeah,
then you could actually read about it in old books and more recent books. You could teach yourself how to weld. I bought a welder and started welding and learned it. You could teach yourself how to use a lathe. A lathe is where you turn the shaft on the from a big piece of steel into a nice shaft for your rotor. We had a workshop on the farm, and then I bought some more equipment on the junkyard. At that time, the going rate was 15 cents a kilo for equipment. So I got a big drilling machine and a big, yeah, lathe and so on that I got for 1 Danish kroner, 15 cents a kilo. And it had this thing that it was difficult, but it was not so that it couldn't be done. If somebody had said, now I want to do thin film solar, yeah, come on, be my guest. That's completely beyond what a private individual can do. This was just within reach.
Yeah.
What then happened was that when I was building my turbine, I got in touch with the local blacksmith, who was also interested in wind power. And we made a simple deal that I should design one for him that he could build from new parts. Mine was all secondhand and self-built and so on. He wanted one that was built from new parts so that he could maybe make a business out of it.
Yeah.
And I built one for him, and it was a success. And then I actually, as has been done ever since, made a larger design for him. And we built two of those and installed at clients. And they also worked very nicely. And then my friend Carly X said, now we build a factory. And at that time, with the time that had passed, I was 21, 22, and I was not going to build a factory. That was completely out of the question.
Yeah.
I was going to university, and I didn't have a clue about money, and I could also see that he didn't. So it was a recipe for disaster. So what we ended up doing was to sit down and say, how do we solve this? We have something. It's working really nice. It seems to be doing
by
things.
Now you're creating energy for a handful of farms.
Yes,
or something
yes,
like
yes.
That. Yeah.
Now we seem to be onto something, but it is beyond us to make it happen.
Yeah.
How does one then? What does one do? And in the end, he was not all in for it. I have to say, he really wanted his factory. But in the end, I persuaded him that we should see if we could find a licensee who could buy our design and yeah, then industrialize it. And we ended up asking a not local, but nearby, within 40, 50 kilometers, factory that felt as if it had the right size and the right mindset, that was doing farm wagons and small truck cranes and cooling systems for ships, whether they would might be interested in this. And that was the Danish company Vestas. And fortunately, they were interested. They had a few, what should we say, prerequisites they wanted completed. They needed to measure how did our turbine do. Did it do what we claimed it did? It turned out it did. And then we ended up doing a license deal where my friend got the freedom to build 10 more turbines, which is what he really wanted. And we had an income from the each turbine that Vestas would produce. And I had an obligation to support them on design. And that was just fantastic. Then we saw this dream, so to speak, that we could start spreading the concept happen, even though it was by definition way beyond our own capabilities. But with this license arrangement, we made it happen.
And today, Vestas is the biggest wind turbine producer in the world.
Yes.
But that's fantastic. Yeah. So it's a 19-year-old boy getting the idea to support his own father's farm. And that basically became the start of what today is a global enterprise with. So could you say that actually your initial ideas, decisions that you made, for instance, which way will the turbine turn, the blades turn, things like that, all of those decisions, are they then, you know, so when you look at it, let me put it another way. When you look at turbines all over the planet today, basically you can refer them back to some of the decisions you made as a very young boy.
I and some others made, including the guy who made the blades. He was the one who decided the direction of rotation. The way it actually went was that the sort of package we had made had elements that were all of them ideas by others. I had a three-bladed rotor. Others had done that before. I had this or that. We had a two-speed operation that maybe was new. I forget that. But we ended up packaging ideas from various places and doing that in a way that was, if not new in the individual elements, then at least doable industrially to make an efficient machine. And that machine, this concept, was essentially unchanged for the next, in the mainstream industry for the next 15, 20 years. And then gradually, of course, it evolved further. But I think it's fair to say that wind turbines of today, wind turbines today offset about 3.5% of global emissions. Out of those, maybe 20-25% have been done by the Danish manufacturers. The rest have been done by Chinese or American or other manufacturers. If you go to a wind farm anywhere in the world with somebody who is not a specialist and say, can you see from here where those turbines are from? The answer is no. They all look the same. They all turn right. They all have three blades. They all this and this and this. And they all represent what in Denmark we had the good luck to be the first ones to do. And it's not just about, some people say, oh, but then you as an individual made this happen. Of course, that's not the truth. I and a wide range of other people, including business people at Vestas who saw the opportunity, including the blade person, Eric, including this and this and this, including many other players.
But nonetheless, you and Eric and other people, handful of people, maybe two, maybe four handfuls of people, made decisions that you can still see today all over the planet.
Yes.
You know, for instance, so the turbines, the blades go clockwise today.
Yes.
But there's no real reason for that. They could have gone the other way, as I understand
it. On the northern hemisphere, we would have a little higher performance if they went the other way.
So why did you choose right?
Yeah, that's actually a good story. Eric, the blade person, started by doing blades in a mold that he had borrowed from the twin schools. He could do a 4.5-meter blade. And at this time, in 1978, it suddenly appeared that the twin schools were a little bit like North Korea in that it was really hardcore and you're not supposed to have girlfriends because you have to have your focus on the case and so on. And when people would stray off, they would be shamed in all public in front of everybody else. And so, yeah, it was really not good. So when Eric was going to do a bigger blade, his wife told him, it has to go the other way than the twin blade. You have to show that you are a man and that you are not a follower of them. And theirs went left, so his blade counterclockwise, so Erik's blade went clockwise. So ultimately, of the hundreds of thousands of wind turbines today, I would say 99.9% go clockwise, because that's what the Danish did. And the Danish did it because they were counterclockwise and clockwise. But because I and others started using Erik's blades that went clockwise, it all traces back to February 1978, when over the morning coffee, Tove said, it goes right.
That is fantastic. Yes. So Tove, so,
Tove made her impression.
That is amazing. So, but, okay, so I've often been asked the question when I've told your story and the story about you and the other pioneers, how you started the adventure of wind power in Denmark. I've often been asked, surely there must have been others in other places of the world trying to do the same things, because the oil crisis made this just such an obvious choice. And as you said, the technology was not that difficult, really. So the question is, how come you succeeded in Denmark where others didn't?
Yeah, you can actually split it into two groups. There's one group of countries where the main effort was driven by government-sponsored initiatives. Mm. That was the case in Germany, in Britain, in Sweden, in many other places, Japan, and so on. There, the underlying logic was this is suited for big machinery from the beginning. That can only be mastered by big industry. We need to retain them in a collaboration. And that meant that it was not driven by innovation and entrepreneurship, but by the government wanting things to happen. Sure. That was not a healthy recipe. Then the other group essentially comprises two countries, the United States and Denmark, where private initiative meant that a large number of companies were created by individuals who wanted to play a role, on the order of 25 companies in each of the two countries. And there we were fortunate that our background was, quite frankly, more primitive than the American. The American background was largely aerospace, helicopters, aircraft, high-end. Our background was farm implements, where...
So the boy from the farm won the competition over the...
Yes.
The rocket scientist from NASA.
They approached it from the low weight, squeezed, if not to the limit, then quite kind of squeezed on the design. And we came to it from it doesn't hurt to put in 5 millimeters more of steel, because it's kind of cheap, and then we feel better about it. Yeah. And what turned out was that some of the many learnings from aerospace, helicopters, aircraft, do not apply to wind power, because of the fact that you are very close to the ground, and turbulence, so the variability of wind, is much harder on a wind turbine than it is on an aircraft or on a helicopter. So the fundamental premise of going to this task with an aerospace start without fully knowing what you're doing is not good. Going to it from a farmer boy point of view, where you had ample resources, we knew even less about turbulence and so on, but we had just been suitably conservative so that the machines could withstand the unexpected high loads. And that was the main reason that essentially almost all the American manufacturers failed relatively early, due to the fact that their machines simply didn't work. They couldn't stand the environment.
What was it in the enabling conditions and the political environment in Denmark in the 1970s that made it possible for investors to make the investments that you needed?
Yeah, that's actually a very good question. The Danish industry became a success, kind of disproportionately so. And that was realized already late 80s, early 90s, that we had kind of put our mark on this branch of renewables. And therefore, it was the subject of a lot of research, what made it happen. And I was interviewed by many people, because I had been in. And ultimately, when I read what the kind of deducted from the interviews of me and many others. And when I looked at my own impressions, I got to four key factors that facilitated this. The first one was that the government, the state, wanted this to happen. We have always in Denmark since 1978, with a small exception when a right-wing government came in 2001 and kind of wanted to put their mark on. That took maybe 18 months or 2 years. Other than that, all governments have always been favorable to renewables in Denmark. Check. You need, if the government doesn't want it to happen, it's a lot more difficult.
Because this means that they will subsidize.
Yes.
It means that they will make the regulation that's necessary.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And what they then did was they did not just sit around and say, we are very positive. They made what we call long-term frame conditions. And they could essentially be boiled down to three sets of conditions. One was that they ensured that there would be a suitable tariff for renewables. The second was one which was simply adding something to electricity price that was sold to the public grid and charging that, which was a very small amount, to the other consumers.
Sure.
The other thing was that they imposed on the authorities this sense, you need to make this happen. The utilities were informed, you need to accept that wind turbines are connected to the grid. Before that, the utilities could have said, oh, you want to build a wind turbine? Wow, great idea. We don't want the power. No, no, you have to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
They couldn't do that. The local authorities were told how to treat applications for building turbines and so on. And the third thing was that they actually did implement this investment subsidy in the early years. So somebody building a wind turbine got a, in the early years, 30% grant from the government.
Yeah.
Later on, that became 30 or 15 or 20, and later on, it was completely abolished because it was not needed anymore.
Sure.
That was condition number two, because that meant that now it became doable. It was not always very attractive, but at least it was not an economic disaster to build wind turbines, and many people were interested. And that meant that the government basically created a market pull. And that's a very different thing from a push, you need to do this.
Yeah.
It is people feel a desire to do something, and out of that desire comes inquiries at wind turbine manufacturers. Then they get to compete. I have one that's bigger or better or cheaper than my colleague. And when the industry competes, you get innovation. And then you get the positive spiral on cost, that they get better. They can build factories because they look into a long-term safe environment because we have these long-term frame conditions. And then industry evolves out of that. And then we had two more. There were sometimes subsidies to strange, so to speak, or unusual demonstration projects, including the first offshore wind farm, which would not have been built if it was not that the government, besides all the other things, had a special focus on that. And then finally, as essentially due to a coincidence, we ended up having a very close relationship between research and industry. And that came about in the way that this subsidy for wind turbines was connected to a requirement for the wind turbine to be of a certain standard, otherwise you could be fooled or cheated. And the a new established institution to certify turbines so that they could receive grants was physically placed where wind research was conducted, which was at something called Risø Test Station here in Denmark. So you had the researchers sitting next to the people approving of the turbines, and the approvers would go out and meet the manufacturers and come back and say, oh, we have an issue because they don't really know this or that. We actually also don't know this or that. And they would speak about that with the researchers next morning. So the researchers very quickly got a focus on things that mattered. They were not in an ivory tower researching on what they felt should was relevant. They were told every morning, this is relevant. And thereby we got this fantastic interaction between industry and research here. If you go out in the world and say, how could you make it happen now? It's not a prerequisite for a developing country that they have their own research. It's not a prerequisite that they want to do the first and therefore have subsidies or so. the long-term frame conditions, that is what is required for investors to feel comfortable. So it's about ensuring power purchase agreements. It's about ensuring that you can actually sell your power for the next so many years and that you can get your earning out, that it's not somehow tied up in a strange currency somewhere. Otherwise, you won't get Western money in. If you do that, you can go to get both local and Western money in. Yeah. They are kind of like the necessity. So we are back to this overriding thing. The government needs to want it to happen. Yeah. If they want it to happen, they can make it happen. You can make it happen everywhere in the world.
So in 1991, a big change happened, because this is when the first offshore wind farm in the world was inaugurated, right, in Denmark?
Yes.
And that's, of course, a major shift going from onshore wind to offshore wind. And
I
would assume that some people would be raising their eyebrows, because it must have seemed like a very complex and an expensive way to create energy at that time. But you were also involved with that.
Yes. The interesting thing is that in the early years of the wind industry, late 70s, around 1980, a lot of the international research was actually on offshore wind. But nothing really happened. And then we had the big boom in California. In 1985, California had 85% of all the installed wind capacity in the world.
Wow.
So it was really the thing that pulled.
Yeah.
And that meant that focus went on onshore. But in the late 80s, the Danish government realized that, we'll run out of space. Yeah. We cannot just rely on onshore for the rest of our lives. What do we do? And then they took the rather bold decision to instruct the two big utility associations in Denmark, one in Western Denmark, one in Eastern Denmark, to each build a 5-megawatt demonstration project. And that's one of the places where they made...
Offshore, yeah.
Where they made subsidies as a kind of demonstration subsidy.
Yeah.
And of course, it was not that easy. We had 20 locations identified, and then we had the Navy, the fishermen, the bird people, and so on. We ended up with two. But they were the two that were built. The first one in 91.
Because the ones, the groups you just mentioned, they were opposed to the offshore wind farms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not opposed, but they had their own interests.
Yeah, sure.
I had the good luck to be involved in the first. And that was, of course, quite a challenge, because nobody had ever done it before. There was a lot of articles about it. Nobody ever went into the detail. How do you actually make the wind turbine withstand the environment?
Just for the listeners, so we're now jumping from in the 70s, where you were just out of high school, having a sabbatical, but now, 20 years later, you work professionally with offshore wind.
Yes, with wind power.
Yeah.
I had ultimately, it had taken me, so to speak. I studied to be a medical doctor. That was not really, in the end, I didn't want to be a medical doctor. Then I studied biology and physics. I ended up kind of saying wind power is more fun.
Yeah.
So I started working professionally with wind in 83, and I became full-time employee in 87 as a technical manager of another Danish company, Bonus. And it was Bonus that built the first offshore wind farm.
Yeah.
And there we had a moderate-sized engineering department, about 10 people. How do you actually build an offshore wind turbine? That was a good question. One of the things we had decided was that we wouldn't build a special turbine. We need to adapt one that we knew was a well-functioning product, because otherwise the risk would be too high.
Sure.
So we took our biggest turbine and marinized it, so to speak. Mm. And it turned out that in the end, what we were seeking was the classical thing for a mathematical proof, necessary and sufficient. As little as possible, but what it took.
Yeah.
And what it took was essentially to paint it properly on the outside, where it saw this harsh offshore environment,
sure.
And protect the inside so that no outside air would ever get into the inside.
Uh-huh.
Just had old secondhand air in the inside,
yeah.
Being recirculated, cooling system to the outside, but the inside totally encapsulated, and then dehumidifiers, so it was totally dry inside the turbine. Your nose would wrinkle. Because it was so dry.
Sure.
And that meant that the inside was crisp. It was always unchanged by the offshore environment. And then we had some issues about how do you actually install such an offshore wind farm. And in the end, we went for the lowest key possible we took the best crane driver from our crane supplier, and his name was Leif. I said, Leif, tomorrow you're going to drive onto a barge with your big crane, and we'll pull you out to sea. But when you're out there, you just pretend that all the blue stuff out there is green, like grass where you normally work, and then you just do what you normally do. And that's how they were installed, by an ordinary onshore crane on a barge. And it worked. It was we benefited a lot from being in sheltered waters in Danish inner seas. We could not have done that in the North Sea.
How big was it?
The turbines, we installed 11 450 kilowatt turbines.
Yeah.
So they were about 1/30th of the turbine ratings we work with now.
Yeah.
35 meter diameter.
To explain that to the listeners, so how big were they compared to, you know, in size compared to today?
Today, the offshore wind turbines that are being contracted today are somewhere between 220 and 250 meters diameter.
Yeah.
This one was 35 meters diameter. We drove the tower in one piece from the tower manufacturer to the port where we sailed them out to the site, because we were afraid that if they were bolted together from two parts, there might be corrosion issues in the flange. And at that time we said to each other, this is the biggest thing we'll ever transport, 32.7 meters, wow. Nowadays we drive 100 meter blades on the roads, that's what you do, bigger blades. So
this was the first offshore wind farm in the world, and today of course most people that are working with these issues see offshore wind as being absolutely key for the decarbonization of the world, basically, but of energy systems in many, many countries. What happened since? Because it, as you implied, that time it was difficult and you could probably only do it because of the certain geographical conditions in Denmark, and you had subsidies and it wasn't economically, financially speaking, a very, very sensitive thing to do, but sensible thing to do. But things developed. What happened?
Yeah, there were actually, you can say there were things that happened sequentially, and then there were some step changes. What happened sequentially was that after the first two demonstration projects, very little happened until 10 years later. Mm. So it did take quite a lot of time, because we were so busy doing onshore wind, before it was realized, this is actually something we need to do. So the first project we did after the 91 project was the one in 2000 in Copenhagen, where we sit now, where we installed 22 megawatt turbines outside the port of Copenhagen at a project called Middelgrunden. And then gradually
people will know them when they, if they've flown to Copenhagen, they'll know them because you can see them when you arrive in planes.
Yes. And then we did one in 2003 that was the biggest in the world. And then kind of gradually grew and so on. And then there were two main events, actually, that happened. One was that a Danish pension fund started investing. They bought their first half share of an offshore wind farm in 2010. And in 2011, this pension fund called Pension Denmark invested in a coming offshore wind farm here in Denmark called Anholt, even before it was built. Mm. Normally it was assumed that the risk was much higher until it stood there. Once it had been installed, you could invest in it, because they actually went out and invested before.
Wow.
And that changed the whole attitude of the financial community. Until then, I'd had many, many meetings. I was a technical manager of this company doing offshore wind turbines. So I had many meetings with investors. And if you kind of condensed what they came with their owners, engineers, they came with consultants and so on and so on. And we had meetings, and they sort of never said loud, but the overriding question was, or issue was, you need to convince us that this is something we can safely put our money into. Mm. After Pension Denmark had invested in Anholt, it was as if overnight it switched. And the question was, do you have any other project we can invest in?
Yeah.
So that was really a cornerstone. After that, after the 1st of January 2012, I never had the question, you need to convince us.
No.
And then what happened next was that in 2015, the British government And they are relevant because UK was a leading country in deployment of offshore wind together with Denmark, started introducing auctions instead of a fixed feed-in tariff. Until then, you knew that you get something on the order of 15 euro cents for your energy per kilowatt hour. And then from 15, they said, oh no, you need to compete with others who can bring in the lowest bid.
Yeah.
And then over the next 5 years, the price dropped to 1/3.
Fantastic.
And there you can say the competition was, of course, the motivation. That was what drove it. But the ability to deliver on that was industrialization. That is the main lever. That's what we have as a very positive spiral in all renewable things, is that once we get scale, we get the cost down, then we get more volume, then we get more scale, then we get the cost further down.
Sure.
There we land in a positive spiral. The best example of that is actually not wind, that's solar power. When I first saw solar power, sort of large scale, was in the US in 1978 at one of the big government laboratories called Sandia National Labs in New Mexico. At that time, their solar panel cost $100 per watt, 100,000 per kilowatt. I thought, wow, this is never ever going to happen. Nowadays, solar panels cost about 30 cents. So a fraction of a percent of what it cost 40 years ago. But it's the same technology. There have been one improvement in 1983 where Martin Green from Australia invented a certain technology that increased the efficiency considerably. But other than that, the panels you see now look like the panels I saw 40 years ago, 45 years ago. And they cost 0.3% of what they cost at the time due to volume. And that's what we had in wind. And that is, of course, what has helped us from what was 20 years ago in the industry. Sounds nice, green power, we like it, can't afford it. To how can we afford not to? That is auctions, so we have competition, and then industrialization that brings down the cost.
And I think I really like that. This is actually something that would be sensible for most countries to do, even if there was no such thing as climate change.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I'm motivated primarily because I want to make a difference in fighting climate change. But it's nice for me to be able to tell opponents of that sentiment, either because they don't believe climate change is a real problem or because they don't feel it's their responsibility to do anything about it, that really it doesn't matter, because wind, both onshore and offshore, is just a good investment.
Yeah, if you take the Middelgrunden project out here, which was paid or funded partly by the local utility, partly by private people investing in it, that has delivered on the promise a uniform energy price through all the years.
Yeah.
You know what you get. If instead you say, oh yeah, I'm relying on coal or oil because, well, it's actually not that stable on energy price. When we had the Ukraine war, coal went up by 600%. And we all know how the oil prices are fluctuating.
Yeah.
It's a completely different world. This is stability. And the more you get engaged, you will end up paying for the first project, of course, you pay the same for the power. But the next project, because in your country you learned how to do it, you are able to do it smarter next time, you can expect that the prices in round figures will keep on dropping for the next project. And then once you have invested, you know your price for the next 25 years. That is stability in a nutshell.
Yeah. To play the devil's advocate, some people would say, well, yes, but wind is inherently unstable because you never know how much it's going to blow.
And that is true. If you look at all the arguments that have been raised against wind power, and I have, as you know, been in it for many years, so I know all the arguments. There'll never be enough wind power. You can't power other than more than a few percent of society. What do we have now? You know that maybe better than I here in Denmark.
Yeah.
60%, 50%, 60% of our electricity comes from wind. Okay. It'll be too expensive. No, it's not. All right. Yeah, but people won't want it. That's why it's a good thing to place it offshore.
Exactly.
Exactly. Because you can get it out of sight. It's bad for the climate. It's actually the best thing you can do for the climate is wind power. It's the lowest emission per kilowatt hour of any electricity source. Okay. But it's not there when we need it. And that is, of course, true if you look at it just on the wind turbine position. And that is why when you speak renewables, we can't get away with a, you can say, single element consideration. We need to look at an energy system. Yeah. And when we look at the energy system, then the variability can be made to go away. Because we can use excess power to make fuels. And when we don't have enough power, we can burn some of those fuels or other ways have stored electricity to deliver when we don't have wind. Yeah. And this is where many people say, oh, you can't do that. We need this. We need fossils. We need so on. That's simply not true. We can make hydrogen or ammonia and store it for years. So even if there's a long, low wind period, we can regenerate the stored wind. We can do short-term storage with batteries. We can do mid-term storage with a number of technologies. It's simply not true that you can't store electricity.
And by the way, you can. This also makes it possible. Hydrogen technology makes it possible to use offshore wind in the parts of our energy systems that cannot be directly electrified.
Exactly, and of course, you can say that it. In my view, it is really very simple. You have kind of like a three-level thing. The upper level is everything that can be electrified must be electrified.
It's the most rational.
It's the most rational. Yeah. Okay, we can't electrify high temperature processes because you can't make heaters that do 1,000
like
degrees.
Steel production or
so on. All right, then you convert part of your electricity into hydrogen. And with hydrogen, we can power a lot of industries. Hydrogen is kind of annoying to store. So we can convert it further into ammonia with some nitrogen from the air, and then we can store it. But there are things that can't be powered by hydrogen, like aviation, aircraft, some other means of transport, a few industrial processes. Plastic making needs other things than hydrogen. There we need bioresources. Mm. And together with electricity and bioresources, we can make methanol and oil and other things that modern society needs. Mm. We don't have an unlimited resource of bioresources. We have an unlimited resource of solar and wind. Therefore, everything we can do based on electricity or hydrogen, we should do. Yeah. And where we can't, we need to use some of our bioresources for that.
Sure.
And then there's enough, more than enough bioresources that we today consider as waste. It's not that we need to change food into fuel. That won't work. But it's waste we can change into
fuel.
And
you're actually also working on that. I'll get back to asking you about that later. But before we get to that point, I'd like to get back to what you said earlier about some of the criticism that's often raised towards wind and other renewables, which is that because it's unstable, we never know if it's there when we have peak consumption. Now, I'd like to try this argument on you and see whether you agree. I suspect that you probably do, which is to say that, well, that's because you're looking at it the wrong way, because for that argument to make sense, it's because you have a base load of something conventional, like coal, and then when you need extra energy, that's when you use the renewables. And that, of course, is not a very rational way to do it. You need to turn it around.
Exactly.
So that the renewables are your base load.
Exactly.
And then you can use the coal when it's necessary.
Yeah, or use your stored renewables. Yeah. That's, of course, my preferred. But until we have that in
until
big enough scale,
some countries
you can have
coal,
what we call a gas peaker, a gas turbine,
yeah,
that helps you when you are peaking in many countries late afternoon because everybody turns on the air conditioner or cooking or whatever.
Yeah.
But the base load needs to be renewables,
exactly.
That's for sure.
So, but then you said it yourself, we were quite fortunate to have the conditions. We have shallow waters, for instance. So what about countries that don't have shallow waters? I know that you're working also now on floating wind.
Yeah, you can say that offshore wind is a big success. But it's a big success in restricted areas such as the North Sea here in Europe, off the east coast of the US, off the coast of China, a few other places. But we don't have to go further from where you and I sit than to the Mediterranean Sea. There you simply cannot do offshore wind power because it gets to be way too deep, yeah, way too fast. And that's where the solution to that is floating offshore wind power. Normal, what we call bottom-fixed offshore wind power, where you have a foundation that stands on the seabed, you can go out to 60, maybe 70 meters. If you go deeper than that, it simply becomes too expensive. Yeah. But you can solve that by having a floating structure that the turbine is mounted on. And then you can place it where you want at any water depth, 1,000 meters, 10,000 meters,
but
it doesn't matter.
But these are still the same huge turbines that are
still
floating.
The same huge turbines. Sometimes people look at it and say, do you want to put that on kind of like a little boat? But the foundations you need for that are also quite big structures, yeah, typically 100 by 100 meters.
Okay.
And then you can actually place them at water depths from anywhere around 50 meters and out to any water depth. And the effect on our resource is that while the conventional bottom-fixed offshore wind resource is roughly speaking equal to the world's electricity consumption today, if we add floating, our commercially available resource is about 10 times the electricity consumption of the world today.
Wow.
Then you can say, do we need 10 times? Why do we need 10 times? But the other thing is, we do need to electrify much more than what we do today. We need electricity.
And we need it for hydrogen.
To make fuels, etc. Sure. And therefore, we need more than our electricity consumption today. But you could power essentially the whole world with offshore wind, with no solar, no fossils, no nuclear, no nothing, if you had offshore wind expanded with floating.
So this brings me to ask you probably the final question, because time is running out. When we produce the hydrogen from the offshore wind or another renewable resource, then you can transform it into ammonia. If you do that, that's fine. You don't need to add any carbon. But if you want to transform it into a fuel that can be used maybe for aviation or maritime transport, there's also ways to go where you actually add carbon in the process, right?
Yes.
That carbon then, of course, if it is to be sustainable, needs to be biogenic.
Yes.
And I know that you're working also with a new invention that's not really new, it's thousands of years old,
yes,
but that can help us solve that problem,
yes,
amongst other problems,
yes,
it solves.
So what we do is that we have a pyrolysis system that takes agricultural waste and converts it partly into carbon fuels and partly into black carbon. We call that biochar. Yeah. Pyrolysis simply means heating it to a high temperature with no oxygen present.
Some people will have an oven at home that does the same, right?
Yes, yeah, yes. But this here is we heat it up to 600 degrees. And then about half of our waste becomes a gas, and about half of our waste becomes black carbon. And the black carbon, if it's wood, it's charcoal. If it is straw, it's kind of like straw charcoal. It has the big benefit that no organisms out in nature can eat black carbon. So when we produce our gas to the fuel, at the same time we take carbon that the plants originally took from the air when they grew and store it away. So we actually end up doing a fuel that is what we call carbon negative, because the more fuel we produce,
the more
carbon we remove from the atmosphere. And that's a thing we are working on quite hard. We and many other players in the world are trying to, or are doing this. We built a plant last year that can do about 4,000 tons of carbon removal as part of fuel production. Mm. This year we are doing one that does something like 40,000 tons of carbon every year out of the atmosphere. And that's kind of fun. That's one of
the
ways
amazing
to go. Yeah.
No, it is, because in comparison with some of the other carbon removal techniques that are out there, carbon capture and storage, for instance, which is also necessary, I'm not at all neglecting that technology, but here we have a technology that actually also produces a fuel.
It produces, so to speak, a value product that we need.
Yeah.
And compared with many other technologies, it is kind of low cost. So we need to get carbon out of the atmosphere. If everybody stopped emitting now, as we sit here, Now, no, there are no emissions anymore. We still have the problem. We have these terrible summers where it's getting hotter and hotter. So even if we don't put any more atom of CO2 into the air, we still have a problem. This is a way to start cleaning up the atmosphere. Yeah, yeah.
No, well, but the IPCC are also quite clear on their conclusions that there is no scenario under which we stay below 1.5 degrees temperature increase without carbon removal.
No.
Negative emissions.
Yes.
So we need technologies like this. So how come, what's the explanation that you're the only person I've ever heard talking about this, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But that's not good news. No, it's not good news. No. Well, I was there also when the Crown Prince inaugurated your factory, so I know the technology very well, and I'm also being a bit provocative now, but it is just to be honest that when we go to international climate conferences and negotiations, it's never one of the technologies that's being mentioned.
No. It's quite interesting because I actually often get this question, isn't it too good to be true?
Yeah, it almost sounds like
And people have a suspicion of things that sound too good to be true. Simlar says, no, it does work. You could argue that when you produce this black carbon that is taken away from the atmosphere, that then that might contain tar products or other bad things that were created by the heat treatment.
Mm.
But there we've had the good luck to team up with the Danish Technical University, and they have developed a method whereby the black carbon you produce does not contain these products.
Sure.
They have simply worked with that for many years, figured out how to do it. That may be one of the reasons why people out in the world are a little cautious
reluctant
about it.
Yeah.
But we're doing all we can. I'm talking about it to make people crazy wherever I get the opportunity.
I love it.
Because it's part of the solution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Henrik, you certainly have been one of the, well, I'm not even exaggerating when saying one of the people on the planet that's already done the most to fight climate change. And it's amazing that you're still at it and you're even now contributing with new technology. So thank you also so much for participating here in my podcast.
Thanks for the kind words and thanks for having me. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've listened to Planet A, a podcast on climate change and what to do about it.